Hi, I'm Jeff DeMarc.
Hello, everybody. My name is Allie Friedland. Give it up for that wonderful music by the Randalls, Amir Khan, and Le Beau Trio.
Welcome to The Word, a storytelling project from the Arcata Playhouse and KHSU Public Radio.
And we'd like to dedicate this evening's stories to Dan O'Gara for his long dedication to our area and telling stories.
The theme our storytellers have been asked to explore this evening is being in community.
And it has been a pleasure to work with people in the community, focusing just a very short workshops on telling personal stories, which is very hard to do.
And we had some help from other storytellers, Paul Woodland and Charlene Storr, and we briefly coached interested members of the community on the development of their various stories.
So, without further ado, our very first storyteller is Jan Bramlett, and the title of her story is First Day of School.
I wasn't used to the cold up north. It was chilly in September. My brother had come up the year before to stay with my mama's people, and he was just like a New Yorker. My daddy made fun of him, said he was like talking like a Yankee. I miss my daddy and all my cousins. They all so far away now. My mama told me I was going to start school at PS 147, 5 blocks from our house. She couldn't take me, though. Mama was a waitress, and she couldn't take no time off from work. She had to work every day so we had enough money to live on. Well, my brother Brucey, he was in 6th grade. He was going to take me. That was good because he knew the way. He stayed with my grandma and grandpa last time Mama went back with Daddy. He didn't want to be hit no more. Well, we started out that day, him and me, we went straight down that big old street. I'd never been down that far before. And there was all these houses all looking the same. And I kept looking at the sidewalk because they was all poking up in different places. Them trees, they get under them big cement squares, lift them right out of the ground. You know they say, step on a crack, break your mama's back. Well, I was just trying not to mess up my new shoes. There was this one place where the sidewalk was up, like the pointy top of a house, and I had to walk clear around that spot. I was trying to remember the different trees so I could find my way home that day. There was this big black thing, had these green spiky balls, nearly hit Brucey in the head. They didn't have trees like that in Memphis. Well, we came walking around this corner, and there was this big brick building, and it had these big windows with kind of cages around them and big stairs. And Brucey pulled me up them stairs, I remember, because I was having a hard time keeping up with them. And he went in these big, heavy doors. I couldn't even reach the handle of the door. We get in, and these grown-ups asking Brucey, where are we going? Well, Brucey just walked right on through, pushed through all of them kids, running every which way like they was late for supper. And he walked straight into this one place where there was this boy standing there in front of these two heavy doors like he owned them. And he had this yellow plastic thing across his chest. Later, I found out he was a guard. Well, Brucey starts going through one of them doors, and that boy, he puts his hand up, and he says, "Stop! You can't go through here." Well, I just stood there looking at him. And Brucey, he said, "Well, this is my sister, and I have to take her to her first grade class." Well, this boy was mean. I could see that. Brucey, he was big, but this boy was bigger. And this boy, Brucey started reaching right around his shoulder so he could go through them doors, and that boy put up his right hand, and he slammed Brucey right flat against the wall. And I just stood there going, "Oh, fight is coming." Well, I don't know exactly what happened next or how I got on the other side of them big, heavy doors. But there I was in this big, long hallway. No Brucey, just me by myself. And there was all these doors, big old wooden doors with windows in them, and I didn't know where I was supposed to go. Well, I walked over one of them doors, and I looked in, and there was all these kids sitting at tables, and this big lady standing there and talking real loud at them. I walked over to another door, same thing, different woman. Well, I stood there, and I thought, well, that boy out there, he ain't gonna let me go out the same way I came in. So I was stuck here. I didn't have no idea which door I was supposed to go in. Wow, I was getting scared. I was fixing to cry. I couldn't move. I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I just started crying. And there wasn't nobody to help me. Except there was this little funny-looking lady. She had squinty eyes, and she looked like a little doll. And she was walking over to me. Ooh, she was talking to me, but these New Yorkers, I couldn't understand what they were saying. They talk so fast. Oh, she wanted to know my name. Well, I told her, Jeanette Bramlett. Mama told me to say Jeanette. Nobody ever called me Jeanette. Well, she took my hand, and I reckon I better go with her because she seemed to know. Oh, she dragged me over to that first door and talked to the lady, and then she dragged me over to another door. And then she drug me all clear down the other end of that hallway, the last door. She went in that door, and she pulled me in behind her. And there was this little lady with white hair, looked kind of like my grandma. And that lady said, "Hello, dear. My name is Mrs. Croak." Well, Mrs. Croak took my hand, and that other lady, she took off. I never did know her name. Well, these kids all were in kindergarten together. And I'd missed it because Mama and Daddy had been moving around so much that year. And the kids in New York, they started school before I even left Memphis. So they all knew each other, and they all talked funny, too. Well, Ms. Croak said, "Here, dear, I think you should go up to the front of the room and introduce yourself to the class." Well, I was still mighty scared, but I'd stop crying, because I figured it seemed like I was supposed to be there. So I started walking up between them tables. And I got to the front of the room in front of them by that blackboard thing. And I turned around and I look out at all them kids. And they's all looking back at me. And there wasn't no sound in that room. And I just stood there and my mouth open. And I said, "Hi, y'all. My name's Jeanette Bramlett. And I'm from Memphis, Tennessee." And them kids, they commenced to laughing, every last one of them. They thought I was the funniest thing. And then Miss Croak, she told me to go sit down by Louis Yersak, an empty chair. Come to find out, he thought he was my boyfriend. And there was three girls in that room. They was all named Susan, and two of them lived down my street. Well, that day, we all walked home together. And then we're cutting up and laughing and jumping around, and I didn't pay no attention to them sidewalks. Them girls, they knew the way.
Woo-hoo! Yeah, Jan. Great. Our next storyteller is Gail Pasco, and the title of her story is My Mother's Stories.
When I was little, Mom would often tell us stories at bedtime. I loved her voice. She'd make it go up and down and louder and softer. And the way she would pause at a moment to emphasize what was coming next. And I also loved that she'd snuggle closer when the scary part was coming. So once she finished reading all the books in the house, the best part would come. She'd make up a story. Oh, how we loved those stories. They were all about, well, let me give you an example. The little girl looked into the window of the bakery, and to see better, she kind of pushed her little mittened hand up against the frosted window and made more space and peered in more intently. And what she saw were cases full of cookies, peanut butter and chocolate chip and oatmeal and raisin and And then the next thing she saw were donuts. And these donuts were glazed donuts, and some had bright colored sprinkles on them, and eclairs, chocolate oozing over the tops of these things. And her stomach started to growl, and she was reminded how hungry she was. But then she turned and saw the best of all, bread. There were all kinds of loaves of bread, different sizes and shapes. There were rolls and biscuits. She could hardly stand it because she could imagine biting into a big piece of bread with butter slathered all over it. Her stomach was just growling with hunger, and her feet were so cold and her hands were so cold. The snow and the mud had just crusted on her little shoes, so she stomped them real heavy to get rid of that. And when she did that, somebody yelled, "Hey, you!" from inside the bakery. And it scared her, and she backed off and turned around and ran just wildly, blindly into the street, right into the path of a car that now was sliding sideways down the icy road. Her eyes got big, and she was waiting to be hit, and an arm came around her waist, pulled her up and back and onto the sidewalk. Both of them fell on the sidewalk and slid around with arms and legs up in the air, and then pretty soon there were more arms and legs up in the air as the whole family came out to help to pull them inside to the really warm, nice bakery. It was so warm inside, her fingers actually felt worse, and her toes felt worse because they'd been so cold for so long. Someone gave her a hot cup of cocoa, and then that nice lady put a blanket around her. She started to warm up. People were saying, "Well, who are you? Where are you from? What's your name, little girl? Where are your parents?" She couldn't say anything. Her lips were dry and cracked. Her teeth were chattering, and she started to cry. Just hours before, she'd run away from the home where so many other little girls and boys like herself had lived. She decided to sneak out that night, and she'd gotten her pillowcase and took some of the special things with her, the hard candy the welfare worker had given her, and a little sweater one of her friends had given her. Though it didn't fit her, it was a gift from her friend. She was going to take that. And then there was this little doll she'd found in a dumpster the week before. And never having had a doll, that too was a treasure. So she grabbed her little pillowcase and was heading out the back door. And one of the caregivers yelled, "Stop! Where are you going? What are you doing?" And she dropped her little satchel of goodies, her treasures, and just ran blindly down the alley, around the corner and another corner. She didn't know where she was going. She was running. Finally, she stopped and realized nobody was chasing her. She heard nothing behind her. Nobody was yelling her name. Nobody was coming for her at all. So she started walking more, and the lights were coming on in the town and lights on in the homes that she was passing. One home in particular really drew her attention, and she walked to the front window and looked inside and saw a family gathered around a dining table. The dad was standing at the head of the table, and he was carving a big roast. The mom was laughing and passing around bowls of food. A little boy and girl sat on one side of the table, and he reached over and yanked on her pigtail. She turned around and slugged him in the arm, and then they laughed. And everybody started to eat, and she saw a loaf of bread at the side of the table. And once again, her stomach just started to growl, and she was hungry and cold, and it started snowing more heavily now. Well, she continued on her way and smelled bread. And that's where she had ended up, in front of the bakery, peering in the window. And now as she sat inside the bakery with her cup of hot cocoa and these really kind people, they helped her upstairs where they lived. And she walked in there and everything looked new. It was shiny and beautiful and it smelled so clean and good. They got her into a bathtub with bubbles. Bubbles! She'd never had a bubble bath. They gave her a big bar of soap, and it smelled like springtime. The older sister helped her out of the bath, got her into some clean clothes that were way too big, but she didn't care. They were warm and clean, and they were the prettiest clothes she'd ever had on. Then they went into the dining room, and oh my gosh, on that table was a big turkey, browned on the top and glistening. a huge bowl of mashed potatoes and gravy next to it and butter melting on top, green beans and cranberry sauce, and there was the bread. Her stomach again just tightened up and hurt. But she saw that bread, and it was so hot, it was still steaming. And all she could do was imagine having a great big piece of that bread, a big piece of bread with butter melting on it. And sure enough, she had that and another and some turkey and potatoes, but and another piece of bread. Pretty soon, that stomach ache was replaced by another stomach ache of being too full. Pretty soon, her eyes got heavy. She could hardly keep her head up. And they carried her in and put her on a nice, soft, clean bed, covered her with warm blankets. And as her head hit the pillow, she realized how warm and full and safe she felt. And though that's the end of the story, every time I remember that, it makes me feel that I'm right there again. Thank you.
Is there any bread for sale out there? So Lauren Axelrod was also part of this project, and she went to the Timber Ridge community and got some stories from residents there who, because of health or travel concerns, could not make it here tonight. So we are blessed to have some clips of their wonderful stories on audio, thanks to Tim Gray and his wonderful recording devices. So you'll hear one now, and I'm getting set up for the next storyteller.
Hey, my name is Jody Rowland. When I got out of high school, I couldn't afford to go to college. I didn't want to stay at my job that I had all through high school, so I joined the Navy. When I decided to join the Navy, I told my mom and my stepdad. My stepdad was irate. Good girls don't join the military. Of course, he was ex-military, you know, during World War II. So I joined anyway, you know. Went to boot camp. Went to hospital corps school at Great Lakes, stopped at my folks on the way to San Francisco. I'm sitting there one day, and he goes, "Go put your uniform on." And I looked at him, I went, "What?" He goes, "Go put your uniform on." And I went, "Okay." So I went in, I put my uniform on, and he goes, "Come on." I went outside the backyard, stood me in front of his most favorite big rose bush and took pictures of me in my uniform. I figured, he didn't think it was such a bad idea after all.
Our next storyteller is Bede Steamblock Smith, and the title of his story is Welcome to Lem and Clem's Cowboy Cookout.
Howdy, folks. And welcome to Lem and Clem's Cowboy Cookout. And boy, are we almighty glad to see each other here. Ain't we, Lem? Lem, yo, Lem. Well, come back to hear from the good old days. But things have been getting better ever since. You done died and come back renewed. Though you were as weak as a kitten when you first rejoined the living. Why? When we got the call from Mercy to gather round and mourn your loss, our family and friends gathered round in a spirit of forgiveness and reconciliation. And in that spirit of forgiveness and reconciliation, we all agreed to do our part, and we asked for mercy to keep you on life support. And though they thought we'd lost our senses, when we says we could sense, you sense our presence. And that's all we had. But finally, he gave a thumbs up and a peace sign, and they decided to operate instead of pull the plug on that date. Well, between us all, a miracle of healing and redemption changed our lives. And Lem being here is the living proof. Ain't that right, Lem? Why, back in the good old days, before you was lost and found, we'd sit by the fire just like this. Tend the fire and rehearse our stories for the Lem and Clem cowboy cookouts along the old wagon trail. Why, I'd juggle and show off my rodeo clown skills. And you, Lem, why, you'd barbecue up a chuck wagon menu that couldn't be beat. And we'd dream of heading out west with a circus wagon to put on a medicine show. Why, we planned we'd figure on settling a homestead together as I'd hitched up with your sister back in Nevada City, at the fairgrounds, no less. And we'd start up the Panacea Retreat, kind of like a dude ranch, with healing, fun, and adventure for the whole family. Well, it took quite a spell, but now we're firing up the barbecue, because we're back in business. We got our act together and put a show on the road to invite y'all to hear how our dreams really did come true. Why? Well, we made it to Humboldt. Humboldt, yeah! A homestead. We set a homestead on the end of the trail, and that's the beginning of our tale. And we are almighty glad to see we all found our way here. Ain't that right? Well, Lem, I suppose he's rolled off to rustle up some grub steaks and fixin' to make our culinary dreams come true. So I'll keep the fire burning and tell our story. You know, because this does remind me of many a time I left Lem tending the fire, go off to get some more wood or something, and he yells, Clem, 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 because he done forgot he's been found and has friends and family around again. Well, every single time I hear him call, I come a-running to make sure he don't fall. And I remind him what condition his condition is in. Well, he asks right away if his family knows he's A-okay, and then he makes sure we are all as well can be, and that allows as we are all A-okay, eh? And then he allows as how he don't know where we're going, and he don't know where we've been. But you know, he knows we are on the way. On the way. Oh, and by the way, along the way, we find out we are the way. Eh? Hey. When he worries that he don't remember where he's living, I reassure him, yes, you can. Because if he draws a blank, he can fill in the blanks. Like so, I says, well, Lem, so why do you think you don't remember where you live? And he says, got a head injury, I guess. And I says, well, what's that called when a head injury makes you forget? Amnesia. That's right. Well, how's a guy with amnesia remember that he's got amnesia? Well, I'm getting better, he says, and he is. So I ask him, and where are you living while you're getting better? And he remembers, Seaview? What county? Humboldt. Where we? In Humboldt. And we both say, in Humboldt, where we party for our health. Yeah. And he has another eureka moment. And the past comes flooding back and starts him spinning again. Songs and yarns from the good old days. And we catch up on the last 20 years all over again. And I remind him of his condition, and I'll do it again and again, because his timeline's been spinning. For when he was clocked, his bell got rung so hard it cracked. He fell off the wagon, got kicked by the mule. When he hit rock bottom, he took his last bottle to the Redeemer and cashed in his chips. And on the day we got the news, I surprised myself because I found myself that morning, before we got the news, gave up the chores. I was setting up the barbecue, playing Lem and Clem, and missing you like I hadn't for a year, bro. I guess being dead is a sobering experience because he's been kinder, wiser ever since. We all work and play to make things better day by day, and if y'all do this too, that miracle of healing and redemption can change your life too. And Lem, being here is the living proof. Hey, thank you. And Lem and I look forward to seeing y'all up at the homestead for another Lem and Clem cowboy cookout, because there's lots more stories where those came from.
All right. Hi, Lem. So our next storyteller, her name is Carol Wolf, and she has a wonderful story called The Rainbow Bridge.
I'm becoming a teacher, and working in a class with three-year-olds, I've learned so much. I've learned about communication, negotiation, compromise, and conflict resolution. And for example, one day, I'm always amazed at how one minute everything can be fine, and then the next the world is coming to an end, and voila, just as quickly everything is okay. For example, one day one of the children had gathered all the stuffed lizards and was saying, "Mine, mine, mine," and another child grabbed one and she grabbed it back, chaos. But with just a little help, a solution was found. "Well, the green lizard is mine, but you can have the purple lizard." And then they pat each other and say, "I'm sorry," and poof, instant friends. Another reason I love working with children is the way they think so creatively and imaginatively. They believe in possibilities and in magic, and they see worlds where unicorns and dragons not only exist, but are friends. So I thought I would share this fairy tale of sorts with you the way I would with the children. And I invite you to close your eyes and listen with your heart the way children do. This is the story of the Rainbow Bridge. On either side of a river, a boy and a girl each lived in their own forest home. The river was powerful and clear and flowed easily between them. A strong wooden bridge reached over the river and connected the boy and the girl. Each day they shared play and laughter, and each night they said goodbye, returning to their forest homes when the stars began to gather. Then one day, the boy and the girl had a disagreement. The boy wanted to play with one of the creatures that lived in the river, but the girl said, "No, I'm afraid of that creature." The boy didn't understand, and they argued. Afterward, the boy felt hurt and angry, and the girl felt hurt and sad. They fell into silence and retreated to their forest homes. That very night, a storm came, and heavy rains filled the once clear river with prickly branches and mud. The winds raged, and the bridge broke. The boy and the girl were stuck on opposite sides of the river. Many days passed. The boy, in his forest home on one side of the river, began to feel lonely. He missed the girl from the other side of the river and the closeness they had once shared. But he still felt hurt. "Why should I be the one to rebuild the bridge?" he thought. And so he continued to be lonely. In her forest home on the other side of the river, the girl felt sad. She missed the boy on the other side of the river. But she still felt hurt that he didn't understand. She wanted to restore the bridge, but she didn't know how, and so she continued to be lonely. Then, one day, a beautiful white eagle flew along the river and landed in front of the boy. The eagle spoke. See clearly as I do. Move beyond the clouds of your hurt and anger and be free. Have vision as I do, and your loneliness will vanish. Share your world once again with the girl across the river. Together you will restore the beauty of the river and the strength of the bridge between you. And then the beautiful white eagle, the magnificent eagle, spread his powerful wings and flew away. In front of the boy lay one white eagle feather. The boy picked up the feather, and he heard the eagle whisper, "Trust, believe in yourself, love will guide the way." Throughout that night, the boy thought about the eagle. He thought about not only what he wanted, but also how the girl felt. And he worked earnestly to clear away his hurt and anger and to understand. By morning, his vision was clear and he was free. His eyes shone with the joy he had forgotten. That same night, after the stars had gathered, a golden lion appeared before the girl. The gentle lion spoke, "Be strong, be true to your heart, release your hurt and sadness, and be free. Walk forward with confidence and grace as I do, and your loneliness will vanish." And then the powerful yet gentle lion strode away. In front of the girl lay a tuft of golden fur. The girl picked up the fur, and she heard the lion whisper, "Trust, believe in yourself, love will guide the way." That night, as she stood on the shore of her sadness, she thought about the lion. She also thought about not only how she felt, but about what the boy wanted. She gained courage from the lion and stepped into her sadness and swam through the darkness. By dawn, she was free. Her heart opened once again with the warmth of trust renewed. The boy and the girl made their way out of the forest to the banks of the river, and they stood looking at each other. Their eyes smiled for the first time in a long while. That same night, as they each journeyed toward healing, the river was also transformed. It flowed now pure and clear as before, but it also shone with a golden light. As the boy and the girl continued to smile at each other, their arms opened wide in welcome. And as their hearts opened to each other once again, a beautiful light began to form. The light became brighter and brighter as it flowed back and forth between them. And suddenly, the beam became seven strands of color that, woven together, spanned the river. And it moved into the arched form of a light bridge, connecting the boy and the girl once again. Now, each night, after the stars have gathered, the boy and the girl cross the rainbow bridge that rests above the golden river. If you listen carefully, you can hear the wind whisper, "Love will guide the way." Thank you.
So each of these storytellers has really had to open their hearts and trust in themselves, in their story, and in you, the audience. It's quite a vulnerable place to be. And next we're going to have another short clip from a Timber Ridge resident.
I'm Charlotte Moore. I fell off one step. My friend was driving her car to take me home, and I reached out for her car and I fell right through. On the way down, I thought of all the places I should land on my body so I wouldn't break anything, so I did. I had bumps all over the place. But I shredded this artery in my leg. I went to the hospital, take x-rays, and there were no cracks. But then I had to get well and recuperate. So they sent me to a K care facility, but it was not adequate to take care of me. So they sent me then to Timber Ridge and was a haven. And there's so much potential here. It's just opportunities are so great. It's so nice to know that we're all protected from elements, the weather and everything. And we have all our needs can be met right here. And this can be and is an example of what could become a great comforting way in the whole United States and the whole world, where people can live their lives in such a way that everything gets better and better and better. And age doesn't have to be a trap. A baby or any age doesn't have to be a trap. We can open the little boxes we tend to put ourselves into by age, and we can grow, keep growing. And I think the future's going to work out ways where everybody's life can be just as happy as mine has been for almost 100 years. I'm 97, and it just seems like it's just went fast. And every period in my life was a learning period. And I think of it as climbing a mountain sometimes when you have problems. But you can climb your mountain, and when you get up there, you get a view that you never had before. And you can do that with all of our problems. We can learn to make the mountains to climb and get a view of life. And I'm proud to be a citizen of the world, the whole planet. We're all together in one community.
So I'm Allie again, and this is my story is entitled Hairdressers and Ripples. Hairdressers are pretty good at relationships. Underneath their careful hands, they hear the most intimate details of their clients' lives. Oh, yes, they actually often make these relationships, these friendships, that can last years, sometimes decades. My mother, for example, she was so loyal to her hairdresser appointment that was once a week for her whole adult life, at least from when I was a little girl, that she would, bar none, nothing would get in the way. She would never be late for that hairdresser appointment. It was so important for her to have her hair coiffed and perfect for church on Sunday that she made it an intense relationship, and that hairdresser was doing her service in kind. The last time that she was in a place for a long time was over 30 years. She had the same hairdresser, and she still keeps in touch with Marcia to this day. Now, hairdressers, hair salons, hairdos, they're about as varietal as flowers are on this earth. There's so many. But my mom, she always got the same one. No kidding. It's been decades. She would go in. Well, she thought her hair was too thin, too flat, too limp. So she would go in and have it washed and curled and puffed and fluffed and teased and combed and patted and sprayed. This huge vaporous cloud of materials, I'm sure they were particulate matters and toxic and all that stuff, would all of a sudden descend around her scalp to make a nice stick strong hair helmet. Right? It moved with her. Never was there one hair out of place. And not only did she have that by the hairdresser every morning, or sometimes if she was going to go out that night again, I was sure she was going to die of overexposure to hairspray. No kidding. You know, I'm one of these sort of natural girls, right? My mom is just dosing herself. I was sure of it. But next week, she turns 93, and so I've reconsidered that thought. Now, I did move her up here from the Bay Area, and she's had to change her hairdresser. And when I go and pick up the hairdresser, well, darn it, if that hairdresser doesn't know more about me than some of my best friends. Well, you know, it's amazing to me. It's because she gets weekly updates. There's all that time washing her hair. My mom's chatting away. There's all that time styling, and it takes some time chatting away. Well, in between those two stations, there is the drying station. And because of the metal contraption that comes clunking down over the scalp, there's no more conversation there. Luckily, I have some space in there, at least while I'm out. But you see, my mom always read a magazine or something like that. It was kind of the woman's little time. Okay, read Women's Day or whatever. But my mom doesn't read anymore because she can't read anymore. Her eyes are not that good. And she says that that has been the hardest loss that she's had to experience in her life. And at her age, she's experienced a lot of losses. A lot of friends and family have passed. She's had to give up her independence. She can't pick herself up from the floor anymore. She can't hear conversations. One-on-one, if you yell at her, she can hear. But when there's two of us and we end up going off into the side, she can't hear it, and it's really hard, and she often gets neglected. And in the car, I try not to talk to her because I'm really having to yell, and I don't want to turn this way. But I do remember when I took her up to Trinidad, and when she still had some eyes to see the view, and we went and looked at the lighthouse and the ocean, and then we took that road to the south of Trinidad that goes winding along those cliffs. And she was exclaiming how scared she was and also how beautiful it was. And so I pulled up facing the ocean and the sky and the sunset. And I said, Mom, below us is Loffenholtz Beach. Loving House B? No, Mom. Loffenholtz. Loving Hole? No, Mom. Loffenholtz. Love and hope. Yes, that's what it is, Mom. It's Love and Hope Beach. How could I not say yes to that? I live with my mom. I'm not just her daughter. I'm her attendant. And every day, every need, every chore, every extra little task is like a rock being thrown into the pond of my life. And besides the disturbance, which I do feel, anymore I feel the ripples, those circles of light and love that spread out across my pond from her profound appreciation of me. And sometimes I watch the rock as it goes through the water column of my life and goes down and down until it settles into the soft mud at the depths of me. And then I realize how much my capacity to give has grown. But I also know what I can't give, which is a good hairdo. So every Friday, I bundle her up, and as painful as it is, whether it's with wheelchair or walker, we get her into the car, and I deliver her to her hairdresser for conversation and hairspray every Friday, 10:30 sharp. Thank you. So I'm very pleased to announce the next storyteller, Sister Soul, And the title of her story is Testing 1, 2, 3.
Life is but a dream, life is but a dream. Do 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 shaboom. When I was a kid growing up in the South Bronx, almost all the fellas did some a cappella singing on the street corner. Music in my neighborhood could be heard on the record player, the jukebox, and always on the radio. I'll bet most of you could name at least one radio DJ who made you feel real, like they even understood you somehow. For me, it was the master DJs like Alan Freed, known as Moondog, Symphony Sid, jumping with my boy Sid in the city, Jocko Henderson, E Diddy Up. Ho, this is Jock, and I'm back on the scene with the record machine. Correct time now, 8:15. And then the only woman DJ I had ever heard, Allison Steele, called herself the Nightbird. The Nightbird played great music back in the early 70s on WNEW. But she did other things on her radio show to make it special, like reading poetry. And one night, she read this poem titled The Mask, and it was about the many faces we put on throughout our lives, or something like that, and I wanted that poem. So I took a chance, and I wrote to her asking about it. Well, in a few days' time, there was that poem in my mailbox. Now, who would have imagined that this unseen lady with her soothing voice coming out of my bedside radio would do that for me? You know, as a kid, I used to wonder, how did someone get to be a disc jockey? Was there some very special school? Was there a test? Well, in 1981, while a student at Humboldt State, I got my own radio show on KHSU. No special school, no test, just a love of music and the desire to share it. And over the years, I'd get some nice fan mail, always enjoyable to be sure. And then, about 23 years ago, I got my first of many fan letters from a most unexpected location. This communique came from T, a prisoner at the now infamous Pelican Bay State Prison. And believe it or not, from then on, T would write me every week, and I would reciprocate. Now, I'm not shy about communicating with folks who end up in prison. Heck, I once spent an evening in the women's house of detention. There are so many stories I could tell you from all of those letters. In addition to the story of T and me, let me share a little about two fellas I've come to know. First, there's Donnie. He was in solitary for decades. I know his mother. It would break your heart. But the amazing thing about Donnie was his ability to create art like that of Jackson Pollock. He painted the most colorful abstracts imaginable. Now, you know, men in solitary are not allowed crayons, colored pencils, nothing. So Donnie would take those delicious M&Ms, you know, the reds, blues, yellow, and greens, and water them down so as to create color and use his long hair as his brush. In fact, his story made it to the front page of the New York Times, July 21st, 2006. Then there's Brown Indian. He writes every week, tracks all the songs I play, and then provides commentary after each one. Hey, sis, that one was on fire. You're mine, and we belong together. Oh, my mom played that one all the time. Now, getting back to T, you know, the guy who wrote me that very first letter. He sent this heartfelt message after picking up a faint radio signal. And that night I was playing lots of Marvin Gaye, and he told me that my music reminded him of home. T was in the very first group of inmates selected to serve time at this new Supermax prison. And that's when my prison education began in earnest. First thing I learned about was solitary confinement. We're humans are locked up in tiny 8x10 windowless concrete tombs where food, otherwise known as slop, is slipped in through a tiny slat in a non-see-through door, and people would be in these miserable cells for 22 and 23 hours a day, sometimes for decades. Luckily for T, he had a very short stay in solitary. Well, after I got T's first letter, his cellie at the time assured him that that lady was never going to write you back once she saw your return address. But I did exactly what the nightbird would have done. And that one letter forever changed our lives. As long as the prison was not on lockdown, T would write and call every week, as I told you. The call sounds like this. This call is from an inmate at Pelican Bay State Prison. To accept, press or say 5. I do both. Well, after a few years into our friendship, I raised the idea to T about coming to live with my husband and me when he gets out. He thought I was crazy. He explained with great certainty, "Sis, maybe one, maybe two people a year who have life sentences with the possibility of parole ever get to go home." And I said, "Well, T, why can't you be that one?" And in that moment, something changed. As the years turned into decades, T and I would dream about his release and the things he would do. He'd finish his college degree, maybe try to get a contractor's license. He could teach fitness classes. T's one of the lucky ones, if you can call ending up in prison lucky. See, he has folks out here in his corner. In prison, he became a very skilled carpenter, even taught himself to draw blueprints. So when he gets out, he will build a well-thought-out and superbly constructed dwelling on our property. Did I mention he was 17 when he entered the system? He's 45 now. Well, the good news is, and it is good news, he's going to finally be released. Now, sometimes dreams actually do come true, and something in us truly believe this. And you want to know something? I am sure that it was the radio. The radio, that simple device that most of us still embrace. With me behind the microphone and T hearing my voice, my songs, got him inspired and take a chance and write this DJ a letter, never imagining it might someday lead to his freedom. And maybe, just maybe, the nightbird would somehow know up there in DJ heaven what her kind gesture to me decades ago set in motion. Life could be a dream, life could be a dream. Do-do-do-do.
That gets me. Okay, we are going to break for a 15-minute intermission, and we are going to be lovingly enjoying the music of the Randall's LeBeau Amerkan Trio. So please go ahead and go out and buy some bread. No, cookies. And see you soon.
Let's hear it for the band. Randall's, LaVol, and Amarcon. Let's hear it for the people in the first half there. My name is Jeff DeMarc. I really like what that woman said, that she was proud to be a citizen of the world. And if we could just get to the top of any mountain, we can get some kind of a view of it. I thought that was a beautiful statement for someone with some kind of wisdom to tell everybody. I used to be a taxi driver in Madison, Wisconsin. I drove a yellow cab for Union Cab Company. And when you're a taxi driver, it's all about quickness and quantity. You want to get people in and out of that cab as fast as you can and do it with great regularity. Load them in, get them to the destination, get the money, load them out, get another fare, load them in, repeat, rinse, wash, do again, over and over and over. And you'd have a 3.5-4 hour period between 4 and 7:30 or so where you could make your money. That was the time you really had to make hay. After that, you would just pick people up, little strays at the airport or somebody out of a bar or something like that. So you were really focused on those 3 hours. Now, if something slowed you down, it could really get you crazy, because with driving around like that, just thinking about money all the time, you could really get in a crazy kind of spiral and get a little manic about the whole thing. And there were times I really understood why Robert De Niro had that mohawk and that crazy grin in Taxi Driver. It started to make a lot of sense when I was under pressure. So if somebody slowed you down, it could really bother you. And there was this one fare, this elderly woman named Gladys. And when you got Gladys, you knew you weren't in for the big bucks in that period. Because unlike most fares where you would actually just stop the cab, they come walking into your cab, and you drive off. For Gladys, you'd have to stop the cab, go into her building, up the elevator, walk down the hallway, knock on her door, and there would be the nicest woman you've ever seen, and she would look at you, oh, hi, and it would be her big day to get out of her apartment. And then the process would begin. She'd hand you her purse and put it in the crook of your arm. Then you would take her walker. Then you would take her arm, and then you would proceed to walk down the hallway with the tiniest, most minuscule, slowest steps in the history of mankind, just kind of crab walking all the way to the elevator, push the button, get down, walk out to the cab, slowly load her in, drive a mile to her favorite little cafe, walk her into the cafe. It would be a $1.65 fare and a 15-cent tip. And she was so pleasant, but it would take 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and your night would be blown, you know? So this one Friday night, everybody's buzzing. All the cab drivers, it's like 5:30. I needed money that weekend for sure. And we're all buzzing around in this state, and all of a sudden the coordinates go out from the dispatcher. Monona and Thor. Everybody knows it's Gladys. And all the cab drivers just take off running as far away from the call as they possibly can. We're like a pack of cats when a door slams. Boom, we're gone. Monona and Thor. Monona and Thor, hey, anybody working out there? The dispatcher knows exactly what's happening. So he tries to smoke us out. Now, if you're a cab driver, you cannot lie about where you are. You have to say it honestly or they could fire you. So the dispatcher goes, 22, where are you? 26. 31. 33, where are you? 38, where are you? That was me. I tell him, okay, 38. 2326 Thor Avenue, you got it, G-I-F-G. I say, what the hell does that mean? Go in for Gladys. And I go, oh, man, Jesus, oh, God, what the hell? What am I thinking, this lone wolf cab driver? Man, oh, God, oh, here it goes, all right, oh, Jesus. So I drive to 2326 Thorpe, park the cab, go walking up the elevator, down the hall, knock on the door. There's Gladys. She's in her best spring coat. She's got her hair done up just perfectly. She's got a vase of beautiful, fresh tulips. And she looks at me, "Oh, it's so nice to see you. What a beautiful spring night." And I take one look at her, and I think, what the hell is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? A cab driver's job is to go in and pick up people who are elderly, people who are lame, people who are drunk, people who don't have money, whatever the situation, that's what the job is. You're not some lone wolf disconnected from everything. You got something to do. And I thought, you know, right there, I just thought, if I don't pick up someone like her, I should just quit right now. And right there, I came up with this philosophy that I've carried forever. Sometimes you gotta go in for Gladys. Because someday, you might be Gladys yourself. And whatever job it is, whatever you're doing, and you're moaning and bitching about it, sometimes it's just G-I-F-G. Go in for Gladys. Thank you very much. Now we're going to hear a little story by Gene Doran. Called The Stupidest Thing I Ever Did.
My name is Gene Doran, but once it was Gene Mortensen, and I was a student in college, and I did the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life at that time. Would you like to hear about it? I was sitting in my dormitory on the deck, and these guys I knew came by, and these guys said, "Hey, you know what we did last night?" I said, "No." He said, "We climbed the M Street Bridge, the tallest bridge in Sacramento." And I said, "That sounds like fun." What a stupid statement, because all of a sudden I was in their car driving over to the bridge. And I got there, and I saw this ladder. They said, "That's how you get up." And I kicked off my shoes, and one at a time, rung over rung, I went over this ladder, no problem, right up to the tip-top of the bridge. And I made the terrible mistake of looking down. And I saw these tiny little cars on the bridge and these tiny little boats in the water of the Sacramento River. And guess, I froze. I just don't know how I was at the top of this bridge, but I just couldn't and go anywhere. And then I got in my mind, I saw a picture of the headline in the Sacramento Bridge. It said, "Co-ed saved from bridge." And didn't say whether it was in the water or where. But I could see that and my folks reading it and thinking, "Oh my God." And that's what I thought, "Oh my God, I've got to get down. I've got to turn around and back and find the rung of the ladder and then start down." And that's what I did. I went one rung at a time, backwards, feeling for the next one down. And when I got down, the fellows were there, and they got my shoes, and we got in the car, and we drove back Davis. We never said anything. We never told anybody. It wasn't a thing to brag on. It was something I thought was the stupidest thing I ever did.
That's a great story. I'd like to welcome our youngest storyteller, Talavan Cohen, with his story, The Ukulele Mogul, Taliban is 13.
Hi, everybody. How are you? Are you enjoying yourselves tonight? Okay, well, I hope you enjoy this story, too. A very long time ago, there was born in the town of Arcata, California, a person by the name of Josiah Hartwood. And now, Josiah's parents were very poor folk. They worked in the fields on a big farm just to stay afloat, and they lived in this little broken-down house thing that none of you respectable people would ever want to live in. And as Josiah grew up, they were more and more burdened by the extra mouth to feed, and eventually they just kind of gave out, and before he was 16, they died. And he knew he would go pretty much the same way if he didn't get a good paying job. So he scouted around for a bit, and pretty soon he found out that there was a job opening as the domestic servant for Arcata's chief of police. But anyway, it was a comfortable, good position, and so he went over to check it out, and he was interviewed by the chief of police himself. And the chief of police was very impressed with his skill and know-how, and at the end pretty much said, "Well, young man, you are a shoo-in for this job. I'm just going to have to ask you, I will have to be dictating some very important top-secret police documents to you. So I need to know that you can read and write well." But now Josiah was looking dejected, and he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I actually never learned how to read or write. My parents kept me working. We had to work, you see, poor people, you know." And so the chief of police pretty much told him then, "I'm sorry, my lad, but there are people just more qualified than you, and I'm going to have to turn you down." And so Josiah was sadly said, "Yes, sir," and he sadly walked away. Now, he was very hungry, and so he went back to his house. He resolved to sell one of his parents' few possessions, this old ukulele. And so he got some money for it, and then instead of, you know, just buying some food, which he needed, he instead went over to a music shop, and he went in and asked them if they had any old broken parts or anything like that, and they said he did. They said they did. So he bought them with his money, and he put them together, arranged them to form a couple of nice ukuleles, and then he sold those. And so it was that he could be found soon afterwards out on his porch calling his wares with a few ukuleles around him. And he started to do, and people liked them, and they bought them profusely. And pretty soon, it became evident that Josiah Hartwood had found his true calling in life. He, aside from being an extremely skilled ukulele designer, who was a very devilishly clever ukulele salesman, he sort of like you have these crazes nowadays where people want to buy the strangest things. Back then, he made them all want to buy ukuleles. And when he expanded out of the madness of Humboldt County into the rest of America, everybody else somehow in those other places wanted to buy his ukuleles too. So by the time, you know, only maybe a bit more than a decade after he was pretty much penniless, Josiah Hartwood had achieved had morphed into the world's only respected ukulele mogul. And he was very respected. And now at this point, he went over to New York because he wanted to buy a large cargo arriving from all the way from South America of rare wood for his ukuleles. And he went over and he bought them, but he needed to borrow the money because they were $1 million. And so he went over to the bank and was ushered by, you know, a couple of official-looking guys into a back room where the rich people did business. And they're sitting resplendent in, you know, his nice suit and, you know, the trimmed gray, totally gray hair and totally gray beard and no mustache look was J.P. Morgan himself. And he rose up to greet Miss Josiah Hartwood, and he said, "Well, hello, I believe you are Mr. Hartwood, and you want to borrow some money from me?" And Josiah Hartwood said, "Yes, yes, Mr. Morgan, I'm looking to borrow $1 million from you. And if I may add, I've been so excited to meet you. You're like the greatest businessman ever." And so if I'd been J.P. Morgan, I would have just agreed, but he was gentlemanly, so he acknowledged with a thank you. And he also said, "Mr. Hartwood, I have been very keen to meet you as well. You are the epitome of the American dream. You have built up yourself from nothing using only your ingenuity and your skill. Now, let's get down to business." He took out a form from under his desk and he slid it across the table in a very brisk, you know, cool way. And he said, pointed to a part on the form and said, "Just sign here and $1 million is yours." And now Josiah Hartwood, he was looking a bit more uneasy now, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm illiterate. Is there some other way I can get the money? I can't just sign. I don't know how to read or write." So J.P. Morgan, you know, he stood up again from the chair, and he was incredulous. You could see it on his face, and he was, before he could help himself, he burst out, "My God, Mr. Hartwood, you are illiterate and still a millionaire? And what a great waste if you had just learned how to read or write when you were but a child. Can you imagine what amazing place in the world you could have held?" And so Josiah Hartwood didn't see what the big deal was. He just sat there and shrugged and said, "Yeah, I can't think. I would have been serving tea for the Arcata chief of police these last 10 years. Thank you. Thank you.
Talavant Cohen, ladies and gentlemen. My friend Maggie Gaynor is going to tell her story, My Moment at the Muni.
I want to dedicate my story to Alex and Wesley and all the young people over the years who've asked me for career planning advice. On Tuesday, April 12th, 1977, U.S. Representative Phil Burton and two other members of the House Subcommittee on Park Expansion flew over the Tall Trees Grove, Emerald Creek, and other parts of Redwood National Park in an Army helicopter. It was big news. The next day, Wednesday, for me was like every other regular work day. While I drove to work, I listened to Casey and the Sunshine Band play "I'm Your Boogeyman," and ABBA sang "Dancing Queen" on the radio. And I remember 1977 as kind of a peak year in 70s disco and ugly fashion, and I was dressed up for work in my polyester and clunky shoes like everybody else I knew. I was 25, and I'd only lived in Humboldt County 3 years, and I was fascinated by all things Redwood Country. It was so different from the Appalachia and Midwest of my childhood. And back there, the economy was going through a really painful transition and changes in industry and agriculture. Factories were closing, and tons of people were out of work. They were calling it the Rust Belt, and it was no place to be for a new college graduate. So I was one of the hordes of young boomers who packed up our hopes and dreams and headed out west to find more opportunity. I got a job at Redwood National Advertising Agency on South Broadway in Eureka. And my boss was a real entrepreneur and mover and shaker in Eureka. He owned several businesses along South Broadway. And he's kind of a hard ass. But on that day, he got all the managers to bring all the employees together to announce to us that we would have most of the day off so that we could participate in a rally and a march to a public hearing held by Congressman Burton on the proposed expansion of Redwood National Park. We all headed over to the courthouse, and when we got there, the excitement was just getting started. There were people streaming in from side streets, the main streets, parking lots, all gathering on the front lawn of the courthouse. And there we listened to the fiery anti-park speeches of Eureka Mayor Sam Sacco and Congressman Don Clausen, a few of the members of the Board of Supervisors, and other community leaders. And they handed out to each one of us picket signs, that just a whole array of messages that said things like, ship Burton and Brown to Japan, and trees are renewable resources, jobs are not. So with our picket signs, we followed the speakers in a march to the Eureka Municipal Auditorium. Besides the economic and political issues that were so important, the average working people of Humboldt County were really afraid. They had of a whole change in their way of life. For decades, they had generations been working in the mills and working in the woods, earning a good living for their families. And everybody knew that park expansion meant there were going to be job losses. By the time we had marched the 10 blocks to the Muni, the crowd had gotten really pumped up. It was much larger and much louder and much hotter. It was a warm, sunny day in Eureka, and we were all sweating in our polyester suits, and I had screaming blisters. More than 2,000 people poured into the Muni. The whole horseshoe-shaped balcony was packed, and every seat on the main floor was filled. When my friends and I got there, we barely had enough room to squeeze in the front door and stand. And this was a big event in 1977 in Eureka. They had the Muni set up so that there was a long row of tables with several mics for the congressmen and their staffs, and then in front of them was a table with two mics for our local speakers. And one by one, local elected officials, employers, union reps, lumber company executives, one by one were called to the front of the hall for their turn at the mics to explain their positions that our economy would be irreparably damaged by the expansion of Redwood National Park. And each time a different speaker would present, the crowd would cheer and applaud like a sports pep rally. And then it was time the final two speakers were called up to the front of the hall where the mics were, the representatives from the city of Arcata. And as they made their way to the front of the hall, everything changed. The crowd hissed and booed and hit them with spitballs. And they stood and they stomped and they shouted in unison, "Boycott Arcata! Boycott Arcata! Boycott Arcata!" It was deafening. And for me, Just a few years earlier, as a student in Ohio, I had been a part of anti-Vietnam War demonstrations. When the crowds got that intense is when they brought out the tear gas and the clubs. So I was queasy and I was really on edge. But I was also really curious. I wanted to know what those people from Arcata were going to say. So I left my friends and I made my way, elbowed my way, squeezed, twisted, and turned through the crowd to get up front where I could really hear and see. And I ended up really up front, right behind a curtain, and I could see the Arcata City Council Mayor and Council Member very close. I could see the beads of sweat on their heads, and I could see the intensity and resolve in their eyes as they spoke in favor of the expansion of Redwood National Park. And I was struck by their courage to speak the truth of their convictions surrounded by such a hostile crowd. We all have turning points in our lives, pivotal moments. If we're lucky, they provide a clear sense of direction and real clarity. In that moment in the Muni, when I listened to the mayor and council member from Arcata, I had two epiphanies. I had a twofer. The first epiphany was that I had traveled so far away from my family and all my friends back in Ohio to avoid the really difficult economic conditions there, only to find here in my new home that I love so much some very similar issues to deal with. And the second and even more epiphany was that in that moment, I found my calling, I decided my career path, and I made a commitment that I wanted to be a part of the work ahead, the hard work ahead of a new future, more diversified economy. I knew that I would never forget my friends who were so worried about how they were going to support their families and if they were going to lose their jobs. But I was equally certain that I wanted to be a part of the future, of creating new jobs, bringing people together, not pitting them against each other, the kinds of jobs that would restore and protect natural resources and benefit the environment. Thank you.
Here's a recorded story by Louise Kretner Wallen-Peterson called I Remember.
I'm Louise Kretner Wallen-Peterson, and I remember the house where I was born. It had a great big kitchen that was always warm. There was a wood stove on one side and a couch by the window and a table that was just right for eight. I remember laying on the couch on the cold and winter days while my mother sewed and mended and or crocheted. I remember laying there listening to the kettle sing. It was such a wonderful feeling. But I remember. Now I was kind of a free spirit because everybody was gone and I had the run of the fields, ran with my old Airedale dog. There were woods on each side of our place. We had kind of a plateau and sloped down on each side into the woods. And I could go down there. My mother didn't care because she knew I'd come back and she was so darn busy she probably didn't know where I was half the time.
Our next storyteller is Marianne Mayday, and her story is Beneath Our Feet.
I began my journey basking on the flanks of the South Fork Mountain in the sun with my hundreds of Rock Brothers, and thousands of Sisters of Sand. That is, until the rains washed us rocks and cobbles and gravels and sand all down the hill slope and plunged us into the mad river below. There we were pushed and pulled and rolled and jumbled and tumbled down past the rapids at Maple Creek, down past the Big Bend at Blue Lake, down past the cows grazing on the Arcata Bottoms, out to the ocean. No rest there, though. We were pushed and pulled, tumbled and jumbled, thrown up and down until a powerful wave plucked me up and threw me onto the strand. The strand, the strand, this beautiful sliver of land between the ocean and the sand dunes. One can hear the waves crash, but we're protected from their strength. The air is full of the smell of salt and even the faint fragrance of the feathery yarrow from above. The strand is the gateway to the complex world of the sand dunes, my new home. The gentle leaves of the sand verbena catch me, and I nestle in at its roots for a while. From here, I can see the intricate dance between the sand and the plants. You see that beech strawberry over there? It sends its tendrils out onto the sand sheet. Sometimes it roots and starts to grow. Other times it gets whipped away by the sand in the wind. There's a mat of seaside daisy, beech pea, goldenrod. Sometimes the sand covers the flowers. Other times the flowers form a carpet and protect the sand from blowing away in the wind. Then the sands shift and the plants respond again. Back and forth, advance, retreat. Somehow the pattern changes all the time, but remains the same year after year. I love it when the wool carder bee comes to visit. In the spring, after the male has its fling, he flees. But then the mother bee meticulously builds an individual nest in the sand for each of the eggs that she lays. But a sand nest isn't enough. At the same time, the beech buckwheat sends up this spike of an eye-catching pink flower, and at its base are leaves covered with a soft gray fuzz. That mother bee goes along and scrapes off the fuzz to line each of her nest cells for her eggs to make a cozy home. So it really takes a buckwheat village to raise a bee. But look at that. Life on the dunes, what looks like a low mound, is actually, on closer inspection, wriggling, writhing, swarming with ants. Thousands of ants. Not the little black ants that find their way to your sugar bowl, but giant cinnamon red ants that are building this warm thatch hut for their queen and her eggs. They speak, not with words, but with smells. They have over 30 cents to tell them where to feed or who to fight. As the wind blows me across the dunes, I come to an area that looks totally different. I've never been one much to tolerate bullies, but here is a husky European beach grass called a Mophila that's invaded the neighborhood. Like a Genghis Khan, it smothered the plants and shackled the sand beneath its roots. What was once a mosaic of pinks and purples and yellows and whites is now transformed into this dingy Amophila ghetto. The grasses are like a gang, staking out and expanding their territory, pushing out the more diverse but vulnerable residents. But all of a sudden I hear laughter, laughter of people from Blue Lake, from Manila, from Arcata, from the Creamery District. They're here to help remove that bully Amophila and restore the dunes. Armed with gloves and shovels, they're going to dig out that grass. They stand at the crest of the dunes for a moment, looking out over what needs to be done. Then they slip and slide down the dune face, kicking up the sand, and whoosh, there I go again.
Kiernan Powers is going to tell her story, Mind Over Matter.
Several years ago, I was living in Eugene, Oregon with my family. I was a hypnotherapist, and I loved taking workshops. Well, one day, I called a colleague in the Seattle area to sign up for a workshop that she was going to be hosting. Her name was Sherry, and she suggested that I stay at her home for that weekend, and I was happy to accept her offer. 2 weeks later, on a Friday in October, I drove up to a small town outside of Seattle where Sherry lived with her husband, Tom. They greeted me, and we chatted, and then I settled myself into the classroom space above the garage for sleep. It was a large open room with thick blue carpet and windows on three sides, quite comfy. When I woke up the next morning, I was fully appreciating their surrounding environment. Outside the back window, I could see a nearby lake and the majestic snow-capped mountains in the distance. I also noticed a large pile of wood in the backyard. When I went downstairs to the kitchen, Sherry greeted me and offered me an incredible invitation. Turns out she was going to be leading a self-empowerment seminar that evening that would culminate in a fire walk. Well, wow, I had to take a minute to think about this. I hadn't really bargained on walking on hot coals, and I was a little intimidated to join a group of RE/MAX realtors. I had done my share of MLM sales, and I knew what it was like to be in a room of hyper salespeople. But Sherry assured me that the group had given a thumbs up for me to join if I wanted to, and this was a unique opportunity. So I just felt like I had to say yes. That evening after the workshop day, a group of about 20 salesmen and women gathered to experience mind over matter. The room was buzzing with anticipation and enthusiasm as we sat in a big circle eating dinner. I felt a little shy, but I was carried along with their enthusiasm. Then Sherry started sharing some background information, some history of firewalk, the tradition that is shared in many cultures, past and present. Some of what I remember is that the first recorded firewalk was discovered in India over 4,000 years ago. It was the account of two Brahmin priests competing to see who could walk on fire the longest. No lack of ego there. And in Rome, the citizens could actually avoid paying their taxes if they could prove that they could walk without burning. In Africa, the Kung Bushmen, they performed fire dance as ritual for deep healing for their tribe. Sherry said that in 1977, two things happened that brought firewalking out of obscurity and into the modern world. One was an article published in the Scientific American that was essentially a how-to guide for firewalking. And the second was that a man named Tolly Birkin experienced a firewalk, and he recognized this as an awesome personal growth tool. Well, he proceeded to teach as many people as he could the connection with the mind-body connection and how to harness that power in order to walk on coals that exceeded 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Next, Sherry passed out 12 by 12 by 1-inch boards. On the top, we wrote our limiting beliefs, and on the bottom, we wrote our goals. And as each of us felt inspired, we walked into the circle where there were two columns of cinder blocks and placed our boards there to experience with very focused intention moving through our limitations to our goals, martial arts style. Well, when it was my turn, I walked up to the center, placed my board just so, raised my arm, and thwack! I had broken that board in two, reminiscent of my karate days, and I had a souvenir. So I was happy if the night ended right there. That would have been fine with me. But no, by now these realtors were really fired up. And they were ready to achieve the impossible. There was electricity in the air. Voices were getting louder and a bit giddy. And it was time to go outside, where Tom had been performing the role of firekeeper. Well, he had started with a wall of wood about 4 foot high and about 15 feet long. And from a blazing fire, he had created a bed of coals about 8 foot wide and 20 feet long. And he kept grooming those coals all night long so that we had a level surface without too much ash on those glowing embers. This being the Seattle area, it was cool and damp. And so those coals felt kind of comforting, like a campfire. And I thought, well, if my feet are cold enough and wet enough, maybe it would be easier to walk on this long length of marshmallow toasting material. Again, I was questioning if I was really going to do this thing, knowing that if I had any doubts in my mind, there was dire consequences. Those coals were 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit after all. All around me, I was hearing chants like, if I can do this, I can do anything. And we're the hottest realtors in Seattle. And we believe we can do it. Well, the first person walks, and there is an explosion of cheering, hooting, and hollering, and lots of hugs for the celebrant. And each walk brings a higher charged reaction. I'm going along with the cheering and thinking, well, it looks pretty easy. Nobody's burned their feet yet. My mind is starting to go blank, like I'm in a trance and time has stopped. After most of the group has already walked, something takes over my body, and there I am standing in front of this bed of coals. I feel the heat. I hesitate a moment. And then I am walking quickly with the sound and sensation of hot popcorn under my feet, all warm and crunchy. I keep my focus way out past the end of that bed of coals. My mind is blank and there is no peripheral vision going on here. I am in an altered state, to be sure. And then I step back onto the cool grass, and I'm filled with a rush of lightness as though I have left fear behind. My heart is racing, and my feet seem to feel every single blade of grass that I'm walking on as several people hug me. And the first thought that I had was, I wonder what my kids are going to think about this. Years later, when I first moved to Humboldt with my family, we were camping at Patrick's Point on a cold gray August. One day I was shopping at the co-op and I noticed a flyer on the bulletin board announcing a fire walk. And I thought, what a fantastic way to start our life here. Well, my husband, four kids, and I all said yes. And now we all have a fire walking story to tell.
Here's a newcomer to the Playhouse, Jackie Dandino, doing her story, working towards a fragrant hole.
That's right. Well, it's lilac season, and as I walk around Blue Lake, I am drawn to these lilac bushes, and I pick them, and the smell of lilac sends me back in time to Alberta, a small farm between Edmonton and Spruce Grove, where there was a lilac bush in our yard. And it was so fragrant that it would overcome all smells of spring. Yes, the silage melting over there from a long winter of baking, and the cow manure just starting to thaw out in the field. Well, none of it could top that lilac bush. And I would sit under that lilac bush in a little fort, and I thought, this is the greatest thing. So I was sitting there one day, and my mom called out, Jackie, come on, you got to come in, we got to get ready, because it was Friday night, and it was time for bingo at the Elks Hall. So I came in, and my dad and my mom and I, we got ready, and we got in the station wagon, and we drove those 5 miles on the gravel road to the Elks Hall in Spruce Grove. And my mom and dad had a key, so we opened the Elks Hall door, and the smell greets me. It is polished wood, natural gas from the stove in the kitchen, and dance chalk. And it's the smell of home, and there's this big, huge elk on the wall, and it's huge and it's stuffed, and I took tap dancing there, and it always freaked me out, and I could never be in the front row. But it is the Elks Hall, and we get to work. My dad goes in the back, and he pulls out the old bingo machine, you know, that has the little white balls that get sucked out, and he calls them. And then we set up all the tables and chairs, and my mom and I, we go back to the snack bar, and we set out the Crispy Crunch and the Crunchy and the Smarties and the Hawkins Cheesies and the old Dutch potato chips and the Pop. And we are ready. My mom brings out the bingo sheets that have like 4 bingo on each sheet. So you rip them off like newspaper. And I am the queen of the dauber. So I take all those little daubers, the white ones with the little handles. There's purple, there's blue, there's green, and there's what? Purple, blue, green, and yellow. And I set them out. And this is my kingdom. And I'm waiting, and we wait, and the door opens, and the whole town of Spruce Grove and all the farmers from the outlying area start filing in with their rabbit's feet, and they buy their pages from my mom, and they're sitting at the table, and my dad's getting ready to call, and my mom rips off 2 sheets for me, and she puts it down under the counter because it's illegal for kids like me to play bingo in Alberta. You know, so I'm sitting there and I have my purple dauber because it's my favorite one, and I'm listening and I hear my dad under the O-74, and I can just see Mrs. Shenfield out there. She's got 8 pages. That's 48 sheets, people, and she's like, she's ready for the next one, and I've just barely made it to the second page. She's got a rabbit foot in one hand, and she is ready to go. And then my dad under the eye 16. And I am thinking, this is so exciting. My illegal bingo game is so close. The 4 corners, this game, I am gonna get it. It's mine. And the smoke hangs in the air and kind of stings my eyes, but I love it. I love it. And then my dad, under the N32, and I feel my mom beside me, her legs, and I look up and I see her face, and she's smiling and playing her bingo cards, and I think, I don't think it gets much better than this. And then, O-64, there's a tension, and then bingo! That's right. Someone won the bingo, and the cards all get mushed up and thrown away. And the next game starts, and the next game, and the next game. And at the end of the night, everyone takes their chairs and puts them to the side, and they go on home. And my mom and dad and I pack up the tables, and we put the bingo machine away, and we pack up the concessions. And then suddenly, I am jettisoned forward to Arcata, California, where I have a family. And at the end of the night, my kids help me put the chairs away, and we sweep the floors, and they take the tickets, and we work the booth. And I realize that the urge to gather, the urge to come together, is so planted in me, in who I am and who I've grown up with. And then I think about those lilacs. That lilac, all those small flowers working together for that fragrant whole. And I take that lilac and I put it in a vase in the center of my table. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'd just like to say, what a fabulous evening of storytelling here in this county. It's exciting, and I hope it's a seed and a germ that'll keep growing. A seed's more positive. And now I'm, unless it's a lovely germ. And now, because it is public radio and it is KHSU, I am going to channel Amy Goodman. Thank you very much. We'd like to thank Allie Freeland, Jan Bramlett, Joey A.O.K., Carol Wolf, Charlotte Moore, Allie Freeland, Sister Soul, Jeff DeMarc, Jean Doran, Tullivan Cohen, Lois Kretner, Wallen, Marianne, Mayday, Kiernan Powers, Jackie Dano, California Council, Creating Public Value, Irene, Ian Hughes, Carl C. Lundgren. We'd also like to thank Paul Woodland, Charlene Storr, Randall Zabola, Omar Khan Trio, David Fernie, Josh, Katie, David, Matt, and all the storytellers here. Thank you very much. Let's have all the storytellers come up on stage for a bow.
Come on out, people. Let's go. Let's go. Yes, take a bow. Woo-hoo. Come on out. Good job. Woo-hoo. Thank you. One more time. Go.
Thank you so much for coming. Tell your friends we're recording it live tomorrow on broadcasting it live on KHSU. So tell your friends to come out and be part of the studio audience. Thank you very much.